Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Peter Frank in Hudson, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
I'm trying to get the people saying
frequency.
Yeah.
You're listening to Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM. This program is Frequency, and my name is Mayuko. Frequency invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a freeform mix of sound made by birds and humans inspired by birds. We started today's show with a track titled Rabbit's Tune by Canadian artist Dalton Alexander. And I got really distracted by a bird sound that sounded to me like a red-eyed vireo or something. Really distracting, and I couldn't really focus on the music, but it was from an album titled Almost Home, If I'm Still Alive, which is a brand new release that just came out at the beginning of this month. And for today's interview, Frequency welcomes Ben Nickley, the executive director of Berkshire Bird Observatory in Egremont, Massachusetts. In this interview, we hear about his Kestrel Nest Box project, which is a project that provides nest sites to American kestrels, which is the smallest falcons in North America, whose population is in steep decline. The project spans southern Berkshire County and bordering counties in New York State as well. And Ben shares how the collaboration with farmers, local nonprofits, town and state governments not only bolsters kestrel populations in our region, but also helps the community build relationships with one another. I hope you enjoy. Thanks for tuning in. This is Bequest.
Well, thank you for taking time to do this interview with me.
Yes, thank you.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Ben Nickley. I'm the executive director of Berkshire Bird Observatory.
Mm-hmm. And could you tell us what Berkshire Bird Observatory is?
Sure. Berkshire Bird Observatory is a 501c3 nonprofit, and our mission is to promote the conservation of birds through science, partnerships, and education. And we work primarily in the Berkshires, Berkshire County, Massachusetts, with a more of a South County focus. But we do get into Connecticut a little bit and New York State because we're in this tri-state area. Some of our projects spill over state lines because, of course, the birds that we study and care about spill over state lines. Many of them are migratory, so they even are international.
Mm-hmm. One of which is the Kestrel Nest Box Project. You started coming into Columbia County recently. Could you tell us what this project is about?
Yeah, sure. So the American Kestrel is a spectacular little falcon. They're a bird of prey, and they're pretty small for a falcon. I like to think of them as pocket falcons. You could almost fit them in your pocket. They're about the size of a blue jay, and they are very bright, vibrant, agile birds. They're really remarkable. And unfortunately, kestrels have experienced steep declines, about 70% declines in the last 50 or so years in the Northeast, in our region here. And so these declines are alarming and they're perplexing. So what we want to know is why they're declining. And there have been a couple of studies, and there are current ongoing studies to get at the causes of these declines. And so what I'm doing locally is putting out bird boxes to provide breeding structures for these birds, because kestrels, even though they're falcons, they're birds of prey, they actually are cavity nesters too. So they will make their nests in big holes in big dead trees. That's the natural sort of nesting structure that they'll use, but they'll also use bird boxes. If you make a big enough bird box for them and you put it up in suitable habitat, they'll use them. So that's a really cool opportunity for us, not only to promote their populations by providing this limiting resource, but also for us to monitor what's going on. So our Kestrel Nest Box project is focused on South Berkshire County, but it also gets into Columbia County and Dutchess County, New York State. And we're putting these boxes out in suitable habitat, open habitat, because kestrels are birds of open country. They like grasslands, pasture land, farmland, weedy hedgerows and wetlands on the margins of their territories are really nice. And dead wood, dead trees, power lines, exposed perches are really good because they do a lot of hunting from exposed perches like that. So I'm going around and looking for good habitat and then making contact with our local landowners, organic farmers, other nonprofits in the area like Columbia Land Conservancy in Columbia County, who has partnered up with us on this, and the Hawthorne Valley Waldorf School and Farmscape Ecology people have partnered up with this. So it's a big collaborative partnership to try to get these boxes out so we can increase the local kestrel population, but also so that we can monitor the boxes and understand which boxes are being used, what's the landscape like around those boxes, and what are the features in the landscape that are likely to lead to successful nests and young of the year fledging from those boxes. So it's a study that's a local study, but we also share our data with a big nonprofit, the Peregrine Fund, which is doing coordinating an American Kestrel partnership that is nationwide, and they'll do a continent-wide actually scale analysis on this data that we contribute to them.
So how many boxes have you installed so far, and what's the percentage look like with the next nest boxes being occupied?
Right. So this year, right now, I think we're at 54 boxes, which is quite a few.
Yes.
And last year we were about half of that. So many of these boxes just went up this winter to be ready for the birds in the spring when they started arriving. And I just finished our second nest check. And as of now, we have 15 of those boxes with kestrels in them, either eggs or chicks in mm-hmm. the boxes. So that's about a 30% occupancy rate, which is actually really good. We don't ever expect to be anywhere near like 100% for these, you know. Right. Other people that have kestrel nest box trails, you know, the range is somewhere from like 10% to maybe 40% occupancy. So we're kind of right in the middle of that, and I'm very excited about that. And you know, one of the reasons that our occupancy, maybe it could be a little bit higher, but my aim is to span the habitat gradient, the gradient of areas that kestrels might use, because I don't want to bias my study by just putting boxes in areas that I think are just perfect for kestrels, right? Mm-hmm. I want the data to tell me what kestrels need and what they want. And so to do that, you need to put some boxes out in maybe marginally suitable habitats and see if they get used and see if they're successful.
Mm-hmm. So all boxes are installed. It's aimed to be in the suitable habitat. You make the assessment of the field, but still, like you said, some succeed and some stay unoccupied.
That's right. But so this project started 3 years ago with just a couple of boxes, and we've seen some sites that were not occupied in previous years being occupied this year. So also, as we increase the local kestrel population, maybe more of those boxes in habitats that maybe weren't the best will become occupied. So it'll be interesting to see how these things change over time. And then another component to this project is I'm going to color band these birds so we can field identify them as individuals going forward. So I'll color band the chicks this year, and then next year I hope to enlist the help of some of our local birders, maybe some birders from Columbia County as well,
sure,
to try to put binoculars on these birds and see if maybe a bird that came from a box here at Jug End, if it shows up in Columbia County or something like that. So we want to learn more about their movement patterns as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just one final thing, our state ornithologist Drew Witz is going to come out this summer and put some MODIS tags on some of our kestrels. And MODIS is a remote telemetry system where a bird with a MODIS tag, if it flies within 15 kilometers of a MODIS tower, it'll ping that tower and the tower will say, oh, that individual was here at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And these towers are all over the place, so we can learn about their migration too, really learn a lot about where they're moving, stopover habitat and things like that. So
yeah, I've heard
really
of that.
Exciting.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
But so have you made any observation as to, like, in addition to maybe with the population, but any factor, environmental factor that maybe encourage kestrel to nest?
Just features on the landscape that I think they really hone in on and need are exposed perches around good sort of grassland habitat. So big dead trees with dead limbs. Dead wood really means a lot. It's very important for a lot of insect species, a lot of our cavity nesting birds, whether they're primary cavity nesters like woodpeckers or secondary cavity users like kestrels. You know, dead trees are really an important feature on the landscape. And then also, you know, just weedy margins, you know. There's this idea that, you know, cutting everything down and trimming everything up is clean or better or tidy. But, you know, it's those weedy margins that a lot of our wildlife really depend on in working landscapes to be around human activity. So hedgerows can be really good. Wetlands, you know, protected wetlands on the edge of an open field. Those provide the habitat for a lot of prey species that kestrels depend on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
right, because there's the study around insect population decrease closely linked to maybe kestrel population.
Definitely. So, you know, grasshoppers, they eat a lot of grasshoppers and other big insects. And so to have those, the insect abundance and diversity, you really need diversity in the plant life and, you know, farming practices that kind of promote insects mm-hmm. as well.
What about the competition with some other birds?
Yeah, so the biggest thing for us is the European starling, which is an introduced species that it's considered invasive. They have huge population numbers, and they're cavity nesters. So starlings will compete for kestrels for the boxes that we put out. I've had to evict starling nests from many of our boxes. And you know, you would think, well, a kestrel's a falcon, you know.
Right.
They've got talons. They will eat birds occasionally. Not often, but occasionally. And I've actually seen them take down starlings before.
Mm-hmm.
But starlings are tenacious, and if they get in a box, they can actually hold on to that. If they get in there first, they can actually outcompete the kestrels for some of these sites. And so that's the biggest thing. In terms of our other birds of prey, they don't really compete with like a red-tailed hawk. You know, that's a bigger bird that's eating much bigger prey. Mm-hmm. They just do a totally different thing. Kestrels will sometimes mob or dive bomb red-tailed hawks to be like, you know, get out of here. We actually see that at Jug End a lot. If a red tail flies over the field where we have a kestrel box, the kestrels come in, they're like, nope, get out of here, you know. But it's not direct competition for food resources or nest sites.
Right.
So the European starling is the biggest one. Yeah.
The one in Over Mountains taken over by tree swallow, I think.
Well, that's not a takeover. That's just maybe the kestrels there weren't paired up or something. And so, you know, and that's great. We're happy to provide a palace for a bluebird or a tree swallow because, you know, those are native birds that are really awesome, cool birds. And, you know, so if I have native birds in our kestrel boxes, I just let them carry on, you know. And if the kestrels show up and there's a tree swallow trying to make a nest, I think the kestrel is going to end up in that box. Yeah.
So there's not so much like strategy around the box design to eliminate certain type of birds. Like I saw some like a little nut, like a bolt nut hanging down by the nest box entrance to discourage house sparrows. This is for a littler nest box for eastern bluebird or
for
something.
For kestrels, there's really nothing we can do, as far as I know, around the box to discourage starlings because kestrels need a big cavity that would allow, you know, a much smaller bird like a starling to get in there. But I mean, that's interesting to think about if there could be a design that might help. But yeah, I don't know of anything.
For now. So where's the collected data going and how will it be used?
Yeah, so for the Kestrel project, I have my own database, of course, on my computer, and I will do my own local analysis based on the data that I collect. But I don't just keep the data to myself. I share it with our partners. So one of our partners is Mass Wildlife, the state wildlife agency in Massachusetts. They get all of our data, not just from our Kestrel project, but also from our migration monitoring banding, which we're doing here today at Jug End. And then I also share our data with the Peregrine Fund, which I mentioned before is a big nonprofit focused on raptor conservation, not just of kestrels, but of all birds of prey. And they have a team of scientists that can do a continent scale analysis on data from these various kestrel nest box projects that are going on all across North America to understand what's causing kestrel declines range-wide. So they can do the big scale analysis and we contribute, but we can do a local analysis to try to figure out what our birds need locally here in Berkshire County and Columbia County and some parts of Connecticut and Eastern New York.
Mm-hmm. Right. With the kestrel, it's not as clear as to, there's no clear cause that you can pinpoint. Like with bald eagle, there was DDT.
Sure.
But it's not like that with kestrel.
There's a lot of contributing factors probably. So insect declines are definitely a factor. Lack of suitable nesting structures, you know.
Right.
Just sort of clean, big farm, big agricultural practices. Reforestation in the Northeast is another thing because these are birds of open country, and so we've lost some of our open grasslands, and kestrels sort of need that. So there's a number of contributing factors, and we kind of want to figure out, you know, what they need in our area.
Mm-hmm. So that's really one of the goals of this project. And so it seems really amazing to me that, you know, not everybody cares about kestrel, not everybody even knows what kestrel is.
Sure.
How do you get them interested in involved? Because it seems like this kestrel nest box project is really bringing community together.
Yeah, it is. It's a big collaborative project with, you know, other nonprofits, government agencies, local towns, and also local people, landowners, private individuals. And so when I go to someone's farm or whatever and you know, reach out, I love it when they don't know what a kestrel is because it gives me an opportunity to just show them a picture and like, look at this spectacular bird that's around, you know, that, that could potentially use your farm. And guess what? They eat, you know, insects. They eat mice and voles and things like that too. So there's a benefit for having them around on the landscape. And it's just an easy thing to pitch, right? Kestrels are spectacular birds. They're absolutely stunning, not just in their plumage, but in their behavior, how they fly. They can do this flutter butterfly flight. They can kite in the winds. You know, they're a falcon with these aerial high-speed chases and things like that. So it's really kind of easy for me to get people interested. And what I love is, you know, it helps me connect with people and get them interested not just about kestrels, but conservation, mm-hmm. habitats, and birds in general. So kestrels are a great ambassador species for open land and also lands that are working lands, how we can use our working lands to support wildlife alongside agricultural use and things like that, which of course we need, right? We all depend on farms, right, for food. So I think the kestrel, I mean, in our community here in the Berkshires, there's been overwhelming support for this. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of conservation-minded people out here, and so it's been very easy to connect and to build, you know, a community and a partnership here locally with kestrels sort of, you know, right at the center of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you sound like the perfect salesperson for pitching Kestrel Project. But sometimes it's so hard to engage with people. I mean, Molly was just talking about piping plover that you mentioned, that they nest in the beach. I mean, this is in the city's case, and try to have a conversation with people and to show them what they look like. This is such a cute bird. Mm-hmm. Some people just don't want to engage, or in more closer case in Hillsdale in Bojan Park about the mowing practice, you know, it's controversial everywhere. Right. Try to talk to the local town people, like at the town meeting and stuff, trying to pitch, you know, the idea of there's bobolinks nesting there.
Sure.
It's sometimes hard to like get them even like listen
interested.
To.
Yeah. It's tougher sometimes. So when you have like a conflict where for a plover, for example, a piping plover, well, they have to close certain sections of the beach to protect the nesting habitat. But then you have a lot of beachgoers, right, who really are cared about, they're caring about access, their use of the beach. And so that is a challenge that is difficult to navigate, right? But I'm lucky with this project because kestrels don't interfere with anything. It's mm-hmm. not like you can't do, you know, what you're doing on your farm. So it's really just a positive, you know, mm-hmm. and so it doesn't limit what people can do.
Right, there's not so much complexity around balancing people's need the nature conservation, which is always the challenge. But yeah, I just love seeing, you know, people participating in the walks and coming to, you know, hear about what they don't know about and incorporate in their land management and stuff. So it seemed to me like you're providing so much, you know, action plan that people can immediately get onto, which, you know, is really positive, you know, makes people feel like they're doing something. And that's, I think, is a big plus of this Kestrel Nest Box.
Yeah, and they are. I mean, it's a collaboration, and you know, we couldn't do it without the help of landowners who host the boxes, other nonprofits that host them, our volunteers that build the boxes, you know. So it is a huge collaborative effort, and it brings everyone in together to help, mm-hmm. And to help an imperiled bird species that's just really cool. And so it's been, you know, very rewarding for me, and especially because I see the benefits right away, not just with people getting excited about birds, right, and the connections we're making in the community building, but also baby kestrels are flying out of boxes. And so I see the on-the-ground conservation results from our combined efforts. Like, we are making a difference. And, you know, for someone who's trained as a scientist, you know, I write reports, maybe I publish a paper, like, I hope someone maybe read that or something. But you don't always see the tangible benefits. But mm-hmm. this project, I do. I see it in the people we interact with and engage, and I see it in terms of kestrel numbers increasing locally. So it's been very rewarding.
Mm-hmm. So for those people who are listening to this interview, if they want to join that community, what can they do to help?
Yeah, so if people want to help kestrels, they can get in touch with me if it's a landowner or an organization that has open land. And they'd like to host a kestrel box sort of in our area, right, near Berkshire County, Mass. So southeastern, like Columbia County, New York. They can get in touch with me. Also, you know, we always need people to build boxes. If anyone's interested in building a kestrel box, that could be very helpful. And then as a small 501c3 nonprofit, Berkshire Bird Observatory depends on donations from our supporters. So making a contribution, anything, even a small contribution, is immensely important to us. So if you want to find out more information about our Kestrel project or our various other projects, you can find us online at berkshirebirds.org. So check us out.
Okay, thank you. That's all questions.
Thanks. Thank you.
We heard a track titled 13 Eagles by a German artist, Stefan Mikus, from his album Desert Poems. And I am now talking over field recording Klar's piece by Chris Funkhauser, my fellow programmer here at WGXE, and he's the host of Poet Radio, Words and Sounds, that airs on 4th Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks to Ben for the great interview. If you are a private landowner and interested in hosting American kestrels in your field, or if you are good at woodworking and want to build nest boxes for kestrels, or help this project in any way, you can contact Ben at berkshirebirds.org. We focused on Kestrel Nest Box project in this interview, but there are many other projects that Berkshire Bird Observatory has been working on, so if you are interested in learning more from Ben, he has an event in Great Barrington today, this afternoon, from 1 to 2:30 p.m. So if you run right after this show, you can possibly still make it. It says here, Great Barrington Land Conservancy invites you to its annual meeting at St. James Place on Main Street, Great Barrington, to learn more about native and migratory bird species from two local experts, Chip Blake and Ben Nickley. This will be an opportunity to meet Great Barrington Land Conservancy's program leaders and learn more about how you can get involved in stewardship and conservation. Each year, our fields, forests, lakes, and rivers provide the habitat needed for an amazing number of nesting and migratory bird species. A broad range of species is an indicator of our ability to provide healthy and diverse habitats, resources for beginning birders, and opportunities to participate in the newly developing program for bobolink monitoring at the McAllister Wildlife Refuge will be provided. Looks like you need to register for this free program, so it's definitely a good idea to check in before going. You can find more information on hoffmanbirdclub.org. That's one word, hoffmanbirdclub.org. Ben also made a guest appearance on Mishmash on WGXC recently. Mishmash is an experimental freeform radio show hosted by Michelle Kaplan, simulcasts from WBCR. I believe WBCR has an archive, and Mishmash also has its own Mixcloud. So if you look for an episode aired on May 2nd, you will find it. And now, since today's show had a guest from Massachusetts, I'm going to play some bird-inspired music by people who are based in Massachusetts. We are going to listen to several tracks from Kushdili, The Language of Birds, by Dunya Ensemble, a musicians collective and a non-profit record label based in Boston. We're going to start with a track titled A Lesson with the Hermit Thrush. So stay tuned. This is Bequency on WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Seherde ağlayan bülbül, sen ağlama ben ağlayayım. Ciğerim dağlayan bülbül, sen ağlama ben ağlayayım. Bülbül, 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 bülbül. Aşık der ki hala böyle, gideriz biz yola böyle. Felek bildiğini işler. Hemen yüzyıl talep eyle bülbül, 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 aman. Thank you.
we heard a track titled Nightingale, and then Kuzgun, which means, I believe, raven. And then at the top of the set, it was Sehad Alioyan Bulbul, which I believe is Turkish language, and seems to translate to Nightingale crying at dawn. And these tracks were all from Kush Dili, The Language of Birds, an album which is about bird sounds, bird music, and bird poetry from the Middle East and Europe, released in 2008 by Dunya Ensemble, based in Boston. I first visited the Berkshire Bird Observatory's banding station when they were doing the songbird migration monitoring. And it's so incredible to get to see birds so closely, because we always see them very far away on top of the tree canopy and stuff. If we even see them at all, that is. And I have been using this learning app called Larkwire because a local expert birder, Lee McBride, recommended it to me. It's like a flashcard game type of thing, and it's really helpful to learn about birds. And every time I see an indigo bunting female in this game, which is basically a brown, not very descriptive bird, the photo that this app shows me looks like she's got a tiny bit of dark blue in her feathers. And so it was really exciting when we visited the banding station and Ben showed us a female indigo bunting, and to see it so closely and to see indeed there's some dark blue in her feather, and also just all the nuanced shades of brown. It's not just brown. And so I would love to go back to the banding station again and also check out some other Berkshire bird events too, and maybe interview more people from over there in the future. Anyhow, that's it for my show today. This program has been Bequency, and I have been Mayuko. Bequency airs every fourth Saturday of the month at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, so I'll be back on July 27th. If you are interested in listening to the past episode of this show, you can find them at Bequency at tumblr.com. You're listening to Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM. Coming up next is the countdown produced by Tom Rowe, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening. Happy birding, and have a wonderful rest of the weekend.